Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. I've never understood why Vince McMahon thought Jeff Jarrett was goony. Our roundtable panel have never been sent away because we don't do things WWF style. And rest assured, this week's episode is bigger than the moon landing.
I'm G. John Chase, and unfortunately I was one of the idiots that actually thought WCW was going to come out smelling of roses during this invasion angle. My opinion was about as realistic as Stephanie McMahon's breasts, as believable as DDP being a stalker, and about as ill-conceived as Buff Bagwell in the main event of Raw.
I'm Carl Jones, and contrary to popular belief, I was actually the getaway driver for Lance Storm. I actually ran Chris Canyon a close second in the ballot for Alliance MVP, and no matter how desperate I may have been to get involved with the WWF, no one in their right mind could convince me, as hideous as I am, the way to do it is to stalk Undertaker's horse-faced wife.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke. I'm the kind of wrestling fan who doesn't like to read spoilers, so you can only imagine my disappointment when 2 weeks ago I inadvertently read that Rock turned up on Raw. Ironically, it was while I was surfing the internet for rude pictures of Lana. The law does indeed work in mysterious ways.
This is the panel for the 17th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. And you can hear us talk about whether the invasion was always doomed to fail next. Hello everyone and welcome to the 17th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
Let the boobies hit the floor.
Carl Jones.
Sweet liquor eases the pain.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Props to Carl for bringing said liquor.
And on that encouraging note, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all for listening and for the feedback that we got. This is a show that I've been looking forward to for a number of weeks now. Last week we did Wrestling's Missed Opportunities as the podcast theme. And some of you obviously mentioned the invasion as one of the biggest, if not the biggest, missed opportunity in wrestling history. And we decided to kind of parlay that that opinion and that feedback into its own separate show, because talking about invasion and the invasion angle, I think we can all agree around the table, is one of the more immersive topics that we probably discussed in terms of ramifications business-wise for what ended up happening, the death of WCW, and what it led to in the immediate aftermath. But we're going to talk today about, chronologically, the beginning and the end of the WCW and later ECW invasion angle. So going around the table very briefly before we start getting to the timeline of events, what were your thoughts when you heard the news WCW has been purchased by the WWF?
I, like yourself, since we lived at the same place at the time, I was really excited. I was a massive WWE fan, first and foremost. That was my allegiance. I was excited. It was we're going to see all the best talent in the world in the company that I loved the most out of any company in the world. It's exciting times ahead. Let's rock and roll. Surely the best period of wrestling was about to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of like looking at WCW in particular, just turn around saying, well, it can't get any worse than what it was like before, before they sold it, can it? It can't get any worse than
Surely
that.
Surely not.
You know, Jeff Jarrett as champion, so it's kind of like, because
all the things!
Who are you to mock Jeff Jarrett, slapnuts?
Yeah, I was really psyched for it, because it's just like, hopefully, you know, WWE will, or WWF, sorry, at the time, would actually improve the product and would actually get those dream matches that we've been waiting for.
I was stunned. I don't think it really hit me, the significance of them purchasing the company at the time. You just always assumed, a bit like when we talked about TNA in a previous podcast, you kind of assume no matter how bad it gets, it's just going to be around forever.
It's just one of those things.
For as long as we'd grown up watching wrestling, no matter how much we may have been sort of into the WWF product and really sort of disregarded anything else as kids, WCW was always there and it had always been there. So I think it didn't really faze me at the time, because I didn't really know what to think.
I think you absolutely hit the nail on the head there, Carl, with I don't think any of us realised what was happening at the time. Like, I'm not going to speak for you guys, but myself, but when I heard that it was going to, you know, WCW and WWF were essentially going to be one company, it almost felt like, oh my god, this is actually going to be the beginning now. This is going to be the beginning of like the next exciting period in professional wrestling. And you know, as it turns out, little as we know, it was actually more likely the end of a great period of wrestling.
Just to backtrack, March 23rd, WWFE Incorporated purchased all of WCW's major trademarks, the entire WCW videotape library, and the contracts of 24 mid-card wrestlers for a paltry $2.5 million, with $1.8 million of additional costs. So, in terms of what they got it for, they got it for a song. The 24 contracts, just so we know what they had to work with in the very beginning, they signed, along with the purchase, Mike Awesome, Hugh Morris, Lance Storm, Chavo Guerrero Jr., Meat, Johnny the Bull, Shane Helms, Shannon Moore, Evan Courageous, Chuck Palumbo, Sean O'Hare, above average Mike Sanders, Mark Jindrak, Elix Skipper, Kui Wee, Lash LaRue, The Wall, Kaz Hayashi, Jamie Bygard Noble, Yang, Miss Hancock, Reno, Kid Romeo, and Jason Jett, aka Easy Money. This is what they got to work with from the very, very beginning before we move ahead.
2.5 for Kieber alone's worth it. It's like, what's that? 1.25 oh, yeah. per leg? Oh,
yeah. That's not too bad. I mean,
oh, I don't know.
Don't get me wrong, there's some bad names in there, but there's also quite a few decent ones in terms of, obviously, as you just stated, they're all mid-carders. But, you know, there's quite a few decent mid-carders there.
The telling thing about the list that you reeled off there, Liam, is the number of names you mentioned that we never saw again, never saw the light of day on WWF TV.
I think that the kind of the changing goalposts of this, in terms of their intention, the premise, what they were intended to do, changed as it went along, and I think we'll talk about it more obviously as we go along. But
quite drastically, and quite regularly.
I mean, I think you pay 2.5 obviously for the brands alone, and especially in recent years, with DVDs and obviously now the network. Yeah, you can't question the deal, but I think in terms of what the intention was at the time, what they're looking to create with, it's never going to happen with that crew, never. If they were doing the purchase to do just an angle, which is what this turned into, they'd never done this deal. Or the only thing of value was the name WCW. I mean, you could have done a better angle, drew more money by purchasing no logos, no, not even using the name WCW, and bringing in probably three or four of the big guys, which obviously we're going to talk about. But that would be much more effective from a feud point of view, obviously. But it's just, again, changing goalposts as time went along. So.
Just to get into the expectations, we kind of talked briefly there about our initial gut reactions when we saw this. When I threw this out for feedback to you guys, I asked it in the form of three questions, which we're going to get to throughout the course of this podcast, which is, what were your expectations at the very beginning of this whole thing? What was the moment where the angle died for you, and what was your personal high point? Funny pack from the UK Fan Forum on the subject of expectations. I was 14 when the invasion happened and had not watched WCW at all. The only time I was made aware of WCW's existence was when DX did the skits in 1998, so I didn't have any expectations. I was just excited to see new faces. The ideal stranger from Wrestling Forum, obviously, in terms of expectations, what we all did, I guess, at one point in time: Goldberg versus Austin, Taker versus Sting, DDP versus Rock, the NWO versus DX, etc. Tiger Rick from the UK Fan Forum: I was hoping we get WCW run as a separate company with an annual event where the two companies would collide. Seemed like if it could be done that way, there'd be years of big shows. It was probably unrealistic in hindsight. Having said that, this was an idea, Kieran, that you kind of mentioned off air.
Well, yeah, I think this is when they did the purchase, the intention, at least the mooted intention, was to start a separate brand, as has become the common parlance, or a separate company, really. Those inherent problems we'll talk about as we go along. But in principle, if that was the originating idea, in terms of, I think, if it was, that was the intention of creating a standalone separate brand, there wouldn't have been a feud in the, like an invasion. It wouldn't have worked, because you have to have one side winning, one side losing at the end of the day, and when you're trying to start a separate company, that's, you know, you wouldn't do that. But however, it would have been exactly as the guy said, it would have been like an annual thing with probably the internal feuds flowing over onto the bigger picture of like the WCW versus WWF angle. And then branching off in their own directions again. But obviously, as fate would have it, that was never going to be. Would it have worked anyway? History probably says not, to be perfectly honest, but events certainly transpired to guarantee that.
Indeed. And just before we get into your point, Chase, again, we're talking here about whether or not the invasion was doomed to fail from the very beginning, the logistics, what we're working with. We're going to see from start to finish through various sources here, and I'd like to thank Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez for their very useful newsletters and radio shows they did at the time, where I've poached a lot of the information we're going to use today.
Yeah, I think going to a point that Kira made earlier, it was just like, I think it would have been a lot more difficult than anyone could really imagine about, like, if you're going to have WCW as a different company. Because if you take it from a business standpoint as well, Vince McMahon would have to change the whole infrastructure of that company, like all the management areas and so on and so forth, because he wouldn't keep all the people that are already working there, because, you know, there's a reason why WCW failed in the first place. So he'd have to fire a lot of people and replace them with someone. First off, you'd have to wonder, well, who are these people going to be? Is he going to divide his own staff and weaken WWF by moving over to WCW?
Like production crew and things like that.
Agents and so on. Is he going to weaken WWF by moving some of them over, or is he going to try and hire somewhere else? You know, it will be quite tricky. And also, how is Vince McMahon going to manage this? You know, it's a full-time job managing just the WWF. To do WCW,
well, he managed to do it with the XFL. Yeah. So, did he? Yeah, exactly.
Look where that happened.
In a manner of speaking.
But, you know, would he have been able to do WCW as well? Or would he have had to pass the reins to someone else? Which we know, if, you know, we kind of assume we know Vince McMahon, you know, a little bit well anyway, is that Vince McMahon would never do that. He would never pass the reins completely over to someone else. He would have to micromanage everything. So
well,
it's always going to be completely impossible.
Jump in there just briefly, Chase, because you sort of lent the credence to it there. And to piggyback off Kieran's point to some extent, with the original idea of a mooted separate brand, am I not right in thinking that the initial idea floated was that Shane would run that section of the business?
In a large degree, he was going to be, yeah, he was obviously supposed to be the figurehead on screen, but and as we'll get to this in real life as well to some degree. But
I mean, I think Shane wanted that opportunity. Which
obviously,
yeah.
obviously Shane wanted it, and how much Vince would have been able to restrain himself, we'll never really know.
Yeah, and there was part of that thing too where they, at some point they were in negotiations in late 2000 with ECW to try and buy that for Shane to run. So there was always that kind of thing of giving Shane a project away from the WWF to prove that he was good in business, to give him the, you know, the kind of qualifications of the heir apparent, as people thought he was going to be at the time. My, how things have changed. Mr. JL from TPWW, I was honestly hoping for specific storylines with specific wrestlers from each company leading towards a one-off match on pay-per-view. WCW wrestler comes in to take a shot at a specific WWF wrestler, or WWF guy takes a shot at them. Build a storyline on Raw and SmackDown for a month or two, which leads to a pay-per-view, and the selling point of here's your favourite dislike WCW guy fighting a WWF guy. TDK from the UK fan forum, before we leave the subject of expectations, I personally just wanted SmackDown to be replaced with Nitro. I wanted two companies under one overall banner with maybe one or two crossover pay-per-views a year. Of course, we all wanted the big stars to turn up, namely Goldberg for me, or at least Steiner. And when Vince McMahon did that promo reeling off their names to get crowd reaction, I truly thought they'd buy out at least one or two of those contracts. Carl Jones just lit up.
Well, I don't want to go too far off the beaten track, because I'm sure we'll get to it, but that to me was a big initial problem with the angle. You know, Vince being Vince, and he's got the power walk on the go, and he's all cheered up, and he's so excited because he crushed the competition. He reeled off a list of names that he had no idea if he could possibly deliver them.
Yeah,
or not.
I know. We'll get more into this shortly, because yeah, this is oh, coming yeah. up. But just to take the bit by bit to explain the situation, Dave Meltzer at the time mentioned that TNN was not hot on the idea of adding another WWF show when they first bought it. They work on a temporary tentative negotiations and talks to have a late Saturday night slot from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. but again, when they first bought it, that was not by any means something that was in the bag.
It was just Viacom as the parent company, if I'm not mistaken, yeah. were very hesitant on the idea, to say the least. And I suppose from the standpoint of going with the initial idea of they wanted a separate brand, separate TV show, all the things that entails, you would think they'd have had the foresight to see the writing on the wall straight off the bat. You'd have thought they would sat there and think, numbers have tapered off somewhat from 2000. Nobody wanted ECW. I know a lot of the wrestlers have talked about TV deals that may or may not have been out there. There was nothing realistically out there no. viable for the company. The fact that and people can sort of piss and moan about Jamie Kellner all they want. The fact that Turner and AOL pulled the plug on wrestling on TV, obviously that meant that Bischoff was out of the picture in terms of them buying the company. So, you know, the signs were clearly there straight from the get-go.
Obviously, the plan from the beginning was that WCW would be kept as a separate organisation in the very beginning. They would try and rebuild it for likely an interpromotional war in 6 months to a year down the line. The big money contracts, as everybody knows, were kind of stuck with Time Warner, which meant they couldn't get them at the time. And it was believed, and this is a funny quote from The Observer, it is believed there was little to no interest in Kevin Nash, Lex Luger, Rick Steiner, Buff Bagwell, among others. The only high-dollar names WWF has expressed any interest in are Ric Flair, Booker T, and DDP, two of which they would end up getting. One of them would come the day after the Invasion angle ending. What can you say? Now, obviously, on the subject of big names, we're going to get to what we kind of alluded to moments ago. March 26th, Monday Night Raw, and even, you know, the last WCW Nitro, Vince McMahon's ugly mug shows up there too. The big angle with the simulcast, and of course, Vince's, as one of our emails puts it, the victory lap around the ring.
I think that's the perfect way to describe it, because it was, you know, one of Vince's edicts on television, anti-Bischoff, would be to not mention the opposition and by name specifically. This was like his cathartic release of orgasmic explosion of just burying everyone he had a gripe with. It was nothing more than that, I think, really, but
It was great though, because like, as you're probably going to allude to in a minute, Liam, is just like they were. He goes through all the names, doesn't he? He goes through like a few names.
He goes through. Okay, I got the list in my head. It was Hogan, which the fans booed. Luger, the fans booed. Bagwell, who the fans, the females cheered. Especially, cheered. And did him a real solid. Scott Steiner, who got a huge ovation, and Booker T, who also got a good reaction. Goldberg, and then Vince, well, went, oh, hang on, Vince stopped, and he was going to try and move on with his promo, and the fans chanted Goldberg. I don't think originally he was going to do it, and you know, because it was there and you couldn't ignore it. Okay, what about Sting? And the crowd reacts nicely. What about Goldberg? And the place explodes. And right there, they created their very own version of 2000 Scott Hall in WCW, where they were constantly, they hinted at something they weren't going to deliver, which is something you want to touch on, Carl.
Well, yeah, they're setting themselves up for a fall in the process of doing that. Without having any concrete knowledge that you can get these names, you know, the fans are only...
no plan for anything.
Exactly. Exactly, but, you know, you can't fathom someone who's with the intellect of Vince having the sense to go out there and do that. And like you say, it was very much his victory lap. Sort of, he got caught up in the moment, as you can imagine Vince doing. And it was ironic that, when you mentioned it earlier, this wasn't the fans just sort of organically cheering either. This was Vince as the Emperor in the Colosseum with the thumbs up and the thumbs down. This was Vince on steroids.
Yeah. It was probably
Vince on more than usual steroids.
He was properly acting like a child who's just bought Willy Wonka's chocolate factory and hasn't realised he can't eat all the sweets yet. He also, you know, he just fires Jeff Jarrett. Like, we were a lot of glee. Yeah, Jeff Jarrett, you're fired, because obviously all the issues in 99, No Mercy and so on. But yeah, it's just all quite funny, really.
I do love Alvarez's line that he should have charged Jarrett $180,000 to come back to the company to get his money back.
Yeah.
The funny thing about it all is they actually knew from the very beginning that they weren't going to take Goldberg. So I don't know why he did that on the live Raw, because they knew he had $2 million per year for more than 2 years. They made the decision in the first meeting that they weren't going to try and get him, and then he goes and does that. Here we go. In terms of when did the angle die for you, we got our first nomination here. Shane O'Mac version 2 from the UK fan forum. I was 11 when the whole thing went down, so I wasn't privy to the workings of the IWC or anything, but I remember feeling like having Shane as the WCW head immediately made the whole thing feel like just another WWF feud. If Bischoff and Heyman were brought in at the same time as the owners of WCW and ECW, and had Shane and Steph later emerge as the financial backers or something, it would have worked a lot better. Making it the McMahon show made it seem like just another angle rather than a big invasion. That's why for me the ECW revival in 2005 worked so well. Bischoff and Heyman were involved, and using those players made it feel like an individual entity to the WWE.
Yeah,
Shane is the figurehead.
Yeah, that's absolutely really well made point. I didn't actually kind of like necessarily think that at the time, because just obviously the general excitement. But like in kind of hindsight, obviously it was just kind of like, as soon as Shane just comes along, it does just come across as another WWF angle, and you just kind of knew, like, okay, they're not going to be separate companies. You know, the McMahon family is going to link this all together.
I completely agree. This was a massive first sign. It was going to problems ahead, and it didn't end up repeating itself. We talk about the ECW thing. I think we mentioned this earlier. Well, obviously, we're going to talk about it in a bit later on. But when the ECW angle, then the Alliance angle, first went down up until the Stephanie reveal, it was a really hot, interesting angle. It was edgy. It had Heyman there. It felt a little bit authentic, even though a lot of the guys have been in WWF, like the Duds and stuff, been there for ages. It was still felt authentic because of the attitude. Now it's presented complete polar opposite to when you have Shane walk out, and straight away it's, I think, alarm bells for me were flashing. This isn't going down the way it should go down. For all the fuck ups we're going to come to, if it wasn't Lance Storm, if it was Goldberg, and as we say, it was never going to happen. But if it was Flair, then if it was Flair or Bischoff, for fuck's sake, if they'd walked out on one show, Jesus Christ, how exciting would that have been? We all knew it'd been bought. It was one company. It didn't matter. It's just exciting. It's exactly what we wanted. When it was Shane, it was just, as the contributor said, it was just, they're going to do things. They're not going to push the envelope. It's going to be done within their own comfort zone. And for me personally, I just thought if it was going to be a separate company, the two shouldn't mix at all. I just that right there and then, it's the inherent problems that were going to come from it, which were like, well, we'll start right now. WCW cast as baby faces.
No,
if it's not a feud, if it's a feud, it was stupid. It wasn't supposed to be a feud. It was supposed to be launching a company, in which case you need some face. And if you had Flair and Goldberg, it would have worked. It would have more of a chance of working, because people wouldn't. shit all over. Like, yeah. If it was, say, Goldberg in the first match against, it could have been against Bagwell, and it would have been a 2-minute destruction, it would have been perfect. That's all you need to do. But if you don't do that, it's you get what you get, and it's, yeah, fundamentally, those guys as baby faces, and after telling the world for years and its fans for years that WCW sucks, now cheer them.
That's kind of an interesting thing to touch on, and we've talked about this in the past in kind of vague strokes, that tribalism that you had as a wrestling fan growing up, and during those 15 years or so before this all went down, where you were very much one side or the other, and you could kind of blinker back and forth depending on the state of the business, and you always want to keep one eye on what's going on elsewhere. But that WWF tribalism, they spent years telling everybody that WCW was second-rate dog shit. And then here they were at the WWF show. The fans were at the WWF show being told to cheer for WCW.
I think a huge problem by bringing Shane McMahon in straight away on angle is you are instantly taking away all the WCW fans. If you didn't have Shane McMahon there, the WCW fans probably would have continued to stay in tune because they wanted to see what was going to happen with WCW. So you probably would have had that fan base still there, and you could have done that brand extension or the company separation.
That's a bit of a bold statement to make. I'm sure if I agree with
that. Okay, I'll say it's a bold statement then. But it's just but Shane McMahon instantly coming out, I think, just instantly killed off any WCW fans. And, so they were just like, okay, this is going to be another WWF thing. We're not interested. We're leaving. In terms of who would you cast as the babyface or heel in that company, as soon as Shane McMahon came out and the WCW fans, in general, I will assume, left, you're instantly going to make WCW the heels, because the only fans left watching the angle are the WWF ones.
I think, as sort of Kieran alluded to, it had to be Bischoff in the figurehead role. Regardless of your opinions on Bischoff, whether you liked him, whether you hated him, whether you thought he was a charlatan, it had to be him for that figurehead role. To your point, Chase, about WCW fans, I really don't think it would have mattered that much to those hardcore fans. I think the fact that the company was bought out drove them away, in all honesty.
Because this was
the core group of fans who still had their sort of their mindset and their ties to the NWA, Southern Wrestling, or Gritty Wrestling.
These are the ones who stuck through the horrible stuff you were talking about before.
They stuck through thinner and thinner and thinner with this company. And I don't think there was ever a way you could pull those fans on board.
What we haven't mentioned yet as well is the McMahon feud had been going on for years.
Mainly
2000, it was the Four Corners, and that would have overstayed its welcome then. No one wanted to see that. Well, I didn't, and that's all matters to me. But so, more than just being a figurehead that wasn't legit, or it was an angle that we'd seen before as well, and it's so there was nothing new to it. It was always going to be shackled by its overarching kind of premise of being McMahon feud.
However, for the high point, Damage Case and Wrestling Forum said the last Nitro was the high point for him because it was full of possibilities at this point. C4 from Wrestling Forum: the only real highlight for me was the Vince victory lap on Raw. That's where I got it from. Followed by Shane McMahon's subsequent announcement. Moving along in the timeline from that actually very, very amusing episode of Raw and Nitro. In terms of ratings, actually, is the actual rating for Raw was a bit of a disappointment. It did a 4.7. Remember the days when that was a disappointment? The simulcast itself, Raw did a 4.4 to Nitro's 3.5 for a combined 7.9 of people who saw that angle. Here's some funny notes from backstage at the shows. Shawn Michaels was lobbying for Kevin Nash to be brought back, and even suggested that himself, Nash, X-Pac, Triple H, and Justin Credible go to WCW.
Surprise, surprise.
One of those names doesn't belong in that group. Do you think our listeners can figure out which one that name is?
It's X-Pac.
Shane Douglas, who wasn't on the best terms with the WWF anyway, was stupid enough to no-show Nitro and his scheduled match with Rick Steiner. Speaking of stupid people, Lex Luger and Buff Bagwell walked out on Nitro before the show even went on the air. Funny turn of events that he walked out, and we'll get to Mr. Bagwell very shortly.
He's still at the chance, though. So that meant nothing in the end.
Exactly, that's what I mean. That's the crazy thing. Moving along.
It's wrestling.
That Sunday, WrestleMania 17, the WCW guys sitting in the stands along...
Cheap seats.
In the cheap seats.
Cheap seats with the header of WCW Wrestlers.
At least they spelled it right.
It's just a generic bunch in a skybox.
Yeah. And Steve Austin turns heel, which obviously we'll play into things later on. The reason that I kind of put this as a point of note here is because business over the next 2 months of Steve Austin's a heel would tank catastrophically, and again we can get into the details later on. Brian Alvarez from Figure Four Weekly this week, the week of April 1st. The first taping of the new WCW show, which at this point will probably be called Nitro, is scheduled for May 9th in Trenton, New Jersey, and it will be broadcast Saturday from 11 to 1, so the deal apparently was penciled in. The initial ideas from the first meetings were that Test and Billy Gunn would play a key role in the new WCW.
Oh, this angle's heating up already.
this is just, it's just like flashbacks from like more recently, when they were doing the ECW relaunch. I remember reading in the Observer that Orlando Jordan was going to be one of the ones who was going to be like a main guy. 1 week later, in Figure Four Weekly, WCW's first taping has been pushed back a full month to June 9th. April 14th, on the WWF website, they ran a poll asking fans to vote on names for the new WCW TV show. The names listed were WCW Saturday Night Nitro, WCW Hotbox,
that'd be Keebler,
WCW Uprising, WCW Late Night Appetite, WCW...
I'm having flashbacks to the Gold Club for some reason.
Well, it's not going to get any better now.
Late Night Appetite.
WCW Primal Urge. And the kicker, WCW Hard On Saturday Night.
Oh, God. Well, I think we all know what Vince was thinking that weekend when he came up with those names.
Absolutely shocking. 1 week after that, April 21st edition of Figure Four Weekly, WWF has decided to postpone the debut indefinitely. All the dates scheduled for June have been cancelled, and while there is no set start date as of press time, the belief is that it's going to be sometime between mid-June and mid-July. So again, this is just getting pushed back more and more and more as they kind of figure out what an undertaking this really is. This time again, just to stress, Austin is a heel on TV, Taker and Kane is the top baby faces, the Hardys kind of get pushed up and shoved down. The product is starting to feel extremely, extremely stale.
It is. It's feeling very stale, and you've got a situation where much, in an earlier reference to sort of the McMahon overarch, think of the Triple H Austin overarching theme throughout that year. Fans had basically been conditioned after WrestleMania to think that, well, the last 6 months didn't count. Austin's comeback didn't count. Nothing mattered in the end because that feud was quickly sidetracked for an Austin heel turn. So at that point, you're already dealing with a fan base that maybe alienated's too strong a word, but a fan base that's certainly feeling let down by the company.
Backlash and Judgment Day, they were just... I remember them being just really poor pay-per-views.
Raw was dreadful this time every week.
That whole power trip angle, and as you said, like moving Undertaker and Kane up into that main event like feud with them, it was just no Rock as well being a big weakness.
At this point, this is around the time of May 14th, mid-May, it's becoming very obvious that there's a game going on where Time Warner was offering low buyouts, 30 cents on the dollar, to guys like Goldberg, guys like Nash, guys like Flair, guys like Sting, guys like Steiner. These individuals who, you know, they want to have the low buyout offers, thinking that the WWF would come calling anyway and they'll help, you know, offset some of the costs that they'd incurred with all these ridiculous contracts. And the WWF at the same time was playing a game of, we're not going to do anything, we're going to let them sit and wait, and when it comes time, then we'll make our move. In terms of bad business with Steve Austin on top, Raw did a 4.57 the week of May 14th. They did the same number before and after Nitro's existence. In other words, all those WCW fans who no longer had Nitro to watch just stopped watching wrestling altogether, as opposed to tuning into the WWF product. And again, another note on this before we can talk about this a little bit more. Although it's only been a couple of months, the Steve Austin heel turn hasn't been great for business. Since the turn, house show business has been down an average of $141,000 per show. 1 week later, the ticket sales, pay-per-view buys, and Raw ratings continue to fall throughout the month of May. The Raw and SmackDown numbers indicate that not only has the WWF lost every single Nitro viewer that gave the show a chance, but they've also begun to lose WWF viewers. This would end up peaking in June, I think, where there's an episode of SmackDown that did a 3.2 headlined by Spike Dudley and Steve Austin. If you remember that very short-lived push, Carl winces off microphone.
Spike Dudley defending the honour of his girlfriend Molly
Holly.
Oh my god, yeah.
And obviously the reason I mention this, and the reason we go into this in terms of the invasion angle, I'm not sure if this is a panic reaction, this is from Brian Alvarez, but the plan is to start working the WCW guys into angles, probably beginning with King of the Ring and culminating at the July pay-per-view, which is being renamed Invasion. At this point, the plan is not for them to wrestle on the show, but they'll just be involved in some fashion. TNN, they outright told the WWF that they want forgotten to sign some of the big name WCW talent before they do the show. The relaunch got put back to September at the earliest because TNN had no interest in doing a WCW show without those big names.
No, and
a case where both sides don't want to budge. We should probably talk about the whole thing of the pay structure and stuff like that at some point here, even just in brief. The reason they didn't want to pay these big contracts or buy these guys out was because guys like Goldberg on $2 million a year, Nash on $1.6 million a year.
Oh, yeah, but Vince was absolutely terrified of a mutiny from his own troops.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's different. You've got to think it's a different time. It's not like now when the monopoly is set in and they can bend you every bar and
pay you what they want.
Yeah, I think as well, WWF contracts tend to be more incentive based rather than the big lump sum downside guarantees. So it wasn't just the actual figures; it was actual, I think, the structure of the pay as well. So I can understand it, but
yeah, I think all those big money contract wrestlers, I think they all kind of basically fucked themselves in the ass because it was kind of Vince that was in the controlling seat here. Because you know, whilst okay, they got this money from this contract, you know, they got need to be buyout and so on, and Vince is obviously looking for the names. At the same time, all those names that we mentioned did eventually go to WWF, and you know, where were these guys going to go? You know, they're kind of like almost holding themselves up, saying like, oh, you got to pay this money if you want to get us over here. But it's like, well, sorry, if you don't come to WF, where else are you going to go?
They didn't need to go anywhere.
Yeah, but there was nowhere else for them to work.
But they couldn't work anywhere, otherwise they couldn't get the money. That's the point. The thing that about it was, those guys were the smart ones, because they're the ones who could... Okay, you got like 30 guys coming in, and then what, you're going to have 31? Mm. They were more valuable sitting on the shelf, resting up, collecting their guaranteed money. And then, again, to your own point earlier on, look what happened. They bought in every single last one of them. They made their money, and then they got the big deals from WWF.
I would argue that the better perspective of that would be not look, they had to come to the WWF with their tail between their legs because their contracts eventually expired. It was more a case of the WWF got that desperate in the end because business tapered off so much that they had to go to those names.
I think it's indisputable that the winners were the guys who held out, to be honest. So
I think on the subject of contracts and dealing with his own troops at the time for Vince, I think it's worth noting, because there's a recent precedent for it with the way they bought The Rock back. And you heard certain individuals complain about pay and missing out and that sort of thing. You know, not naming any names, CM Punk. but it would have been such a hard sell for Vince to try and you can try and put as positive a spin as you want on it and say to the guys that you're currently paying, you know, I realise this is the company that tried to put us out of business, and I appreciate all your hard work, but if you can just bear with us, what we're going to pay them will filter down to you. Honest. We swear. You know, scouts on.
I'm sure they would have believed. Hook, line, and sinker, the words of it. You
can try that as desperately you want. And I'm sure if you look at numbers, there's probably a case for it. You can say, you know, these guys come in, they help make money, everyone gets money. But it doesn't matter how desperately you try to spin that. In the climate that those guys have been working in for the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, you were never going to be able to sell that to them.
You mentioned desperation, which I want to get to, because by the end of May, the ratings had fallen to the point where desperation is really starting to set in. WCW performers are expected to debut on the show imminently, perhaps as early as this coming Monday's Raw. Although no TV deal has been signed, the idea is to relaunch the company pretty much immediately to lead to the July pay-per-view, which has been renamed Invasion. That show will feature a WWF versus WCW card full of interpromotional matches. Again, desperation. The WWF contacted Scott Hall in May to bring him in for Judgment Day and set him up with a meeting with Shane McMahon. Very little known fact that Scott Hall was, you know, after his horrible, horrible couple of years in WCW, they contacted him, not vice versa. And after the meeting ended, so did apparently all the talk of bringing in Scott Hall.
The thing about Scott Hall and the word desperation just sums it up perfectly.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Because this is the person who was such a pariah to a WCW front office that had historically suspended people for misdemeanors with pay. Scott Steiner can go off on as many rants unscripted on TV as he wants. He's getting suspended with pay. Scott Hall
that'll
was,
teach him.
That'll learn him. Scott Hall was such a pariah that he hadn't been seen on national TV since February of 2000.
Yeah.
I think what we're getting now is that the transition from the initial idea of launching a company to
launching the angle,
through their own struggles on screen to the difficulties they're having in launching, the logistical issues in launching their own a new company. Now it's okay, well, let's take what we got and let's even if the intention was still do it long term, at this point, it, I think it makes a separate brand. From this point particularly is when it's, I think realistically it was never going to happen. As soon as they launched it as a feud, intended for it to be a feud, it is only ever going to be a feud at this point, I think.
Well, if I can just ask Liam there quickly, how long was it time frame wise there from going to, we're still going to look for this maybe the September date for the start of the TV show, and we're going to have people on the fringes at Invasion, to the point where they're actually going to be the focal point of the pay-per-view? Was
that, this is the week
we're talking, a week, May, 2 weeks,
yeah, in the space of 1 week. It was 2 weeks. It was May 14th where that was the plan. The new plan was May 28th.
Because I mean, at that point it just screams to me, and I dare say probably to everyone else around the table, at that point you can just picture, you know, creative and Vince in a room in the Ivory Titan Tower just throwing shit at the wall and seeing if they can get anything to stick.
Yeah, I actually did not know that. I did not know that at any point during this Invasion angle they actually talked to Scott Hall. So, yeah, absolutely really surprising. As a, you know, a Razor Ramon fan back in my youth,
it was a long way from those days.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm about to say. Who can we get? Who's left? Well, there's Scott Hall. Right, find which bar he's in and get him here.
Just to kind of give a little bit of a brief overview, because we mentioned there that there's a transition from promotion to angle. There still was an idea at the time. We might as well go into this now before we hit the actual on-screen stuff. Around this time, May 28th, they made the decision that they were actually going to have WCW Raw. That was, they couldn't get a new time slot. Spike TNN wasn't keen to give them more time, so they were going to split the companies. And what they were going to do was they were going to do, whether it be, you know, the Raw slot up, you know, in the Invasion match, or the, you know, the other suggested angle was Linda McMahon divorcing Vince, which was in the plans at the time anyway, and giving, you know, her half of the WWE TV time to Shane to help him in his company. The idea with WCW Raw was not for it to be its own company necessarily. They were going to merge everybody together. They were going to put everyone and do the draft. So basically, WCW Raw was going to be half WWF guys, and WWF SmackDown would have been half WCW guys. That was the plan, because TNN didn't want a show filled with the mid-carders and not the stars. That was WWF's way of trying to, you know, do everything, try and get every idea and cram it in one, to have half WCW guys on one show and half on the other, and ditto WWF guys.
But still, I mean, that...
pretty much the brand extension.
Yeah, it's the brand extension. They eventually did it,
And what did that mean? It meant absolutely nothing.
It meant fuck all.
To do it, I mean, yeah, when you've got, if you're going to start a company, the WCW guys need to be have their own feuds with other WCW guys on the WCW brand. Otherwise, it is exactly what we've had for the last 10 years or so. So I think fundamentally that was always doomed to fail with that intention.
They'd actually released tickets to a show at the Air Canada Centre in September, and when fans got the tickets in the mail, it said WCW Raw, and they freaked out because they thought they were getting, you know, Austin Angle, the WWF show, the WWF stars. Yeah. On screen now, we're shifting a little bit because the Invasion begins on May 28th. When Lance Storm debuts, super kicking Perry Saturn in the face, we are off.
I had the motor running.
Yeah. What did you think about that at the time? I mean, like, you're going to start this Invasion
in Calgary.
Angle.
Key to notes.
Okay, okay, fair enough. That is a keynote to state that you know you're going to pick a Canadian wrestler while in Calgary. But to start this Invasion angle off, and I do like Lance Storm. Okay. But to kick this Invasion angle off, would you really start with Lance Storm to be the guy who fires the first bullet?
No, absolutely not. I love Lance Storm. I loved his run as the Canadian heavyweight champion. one of the few bright sparks in the dying days of WWE. But you don't pick him in the same way that you don't pick Hugh Morris as the second guy.
June 4th, Hugh Morris!
With his botched moonsault. But before Liam just gets to that quickly, this just epitomises the thought process at that time. There was no great plan for Lance to do the running. Lance just happened to be there.
Yeah.
And it was an off-the-cuff conversation with JR where he said, have you got your gear?
Yeah.
And lo and behold, Lance always had his gear. You know,
he was wearing it already.
Exactly. There was no great plan. It wasn't even at that stage, it wasn't even a case of a few days before, right, let's get Lance on the phone because we're going to be in Calgary. We'll have him do a run. It was a case of, oh, Lance is there talking to JR. Someone collar him quick.
Hugh Morris debuts the following week, and then the following week on SmackDown, Stacy Keibler debuts. And then a lovely bit of sign of the times for this angle. WCW.com does an article where she's listed as more popularly known as Miss Hancock in the now defunct WCW. Yes, WCW.com ran an article calling WCW defunct. And you mentioned whether or not these guys are the right guys to start off. Barty from Wrestling Forum for where the angle died. It didn't really ever start. Leading with guys like Hugh Morris and Lance Storm before a bigger star came in, didn't really sit well. June 18th episode of Raw, Diamond Dallas Page debuts as the Stalker. Have at it, kids.
Right. DDP, right? Okay, now, we already mentioned earlier, like, you know, we've got a lot of people's opinions on at what point during this angle did people kind of get fed up or realise that it was going to go to shit. For me, it was kind of like a three-stage assault on me, like three stages of hell that I was going through. And this was definitely the first stage. It was the treatment of Diamond Dallas Page. It was just like, you know, first off, the actual angle itself, without DDP in it, is just ridiculous, right? We can make as many jokes as we want about, Undertaker's wife. Do you want to jump in there with a joke, Carl, or...?
I would, but by the same time, I don't want the RSPCA knocking at my door.
Well, there we go. The actual angle itself, how it was written, was very poor. But then to pick DDP as well was just atrocious. I mean, if they were going to keep the angle, I don't know who the hell they would pick anyway. What absolutely, like, just infuriates me about his whole treatment, which begins with this fucking reveal, is that when you watch WCW in 2000, like I did, right, and it was terrible... Everybody in that company, in terms of like the Millionaires Club, all those guys, they were phoning it in every night. With the exception of Diamond Dallas Page.
I mean, it's for 99 as well.
Yeah, the 99, yeah. But DDP was the only one who, night in, night out, practically was just giving his all. He didn't think the Raw was over. He thought, like, this is still going on. We can still turn this around, folks. And, like, he was a proper company guy, and he could have been a company guy for WWF as well, because he just wanted to wrestle. He was that kind of guy. He had that sort of a personality. And then for him to just... turn around and be treated like this, given a shitty angle with an Undertaker who we're probably going to go into later is just on a fucking tear. Just on a fucking tear.
Venom will spew from these lips.
Literally trying to just jizz and shit in everybody's face, and it starts with DDP. He gets the first fucking load, and it's just like, there were so many different ways they could have booked DDP that would have been a lot more effective.
It's Secretariat. DDP is stalking Secretariat.
It was just so unbelievable. And just, you know, DDP, you know, bless him and all, he tried to give it his best, like he always does in everything, you know, he does in terms of wrestling. But straight away with that angle, I was just like, oh fuck, you're fucked.
As shit as the angle was, and my biggest problem with it, and if I'm wrong, we'll probably delete this. But it wasn't...
We're live.
Yeah, we're live. It wasn't even directly linked into the WCW.
No, they didn't announce him as a WCW wrestler.
Yeah, he was just a new guy coming in with a feud. And that for me was the biggest... It's like, he's the only guy of true value and actually talk with some charisma who can tell the storyline from the WCW perspective, and he's nothing to do with it at that time. And that for me was the biggest... is eye-opening, more than the actual shitness of the feud and the logistics of Kimberly being smoking.
Yeah. When he does that reveal where he takes the mask off, the fucking pop was freaking huge. Like, he was obviously a big name that they could have done something with, and they just straight away just...
Which takes us back to the thing where when they first wanted to start as a new company, and I understand why they need to be faces. If you actually had some star power, people would have reacted to it in a positive light, even it being WCW, because they react to stars at the end of the day, and that's, you know... Beating an old issue, right? Oh, I don't know what to say. He's beating an old issue with a trout.
It's a coin of phrase. Gee, you weren't the only one here. Low light, this was Loki from UK Fan Forum. Low light were the balls ups around DDP, who should have been one of their massive WCW stars. Just to talk about DDP, company guy. DDP, by taking the buyout and doing this awful angle, lost out on $487,000.
Sorry, can you repeat that again?
$487,000 to do this angle.
Vince, you are a real see you next Tuesday, is all I can say.
The SmackDown following that, right before King of the Ring, the Undertaker promo, which... Undertaker promo, obviously Diamond Dallas Page said he wants to be made famous. Undertaker on SmackDown, the following show, Page, you're not famous because you suck. Taker buried WCW as an organization so severely that the promo is almost completely edited off the show, and they only leave in the Diamond Dallas Page references.
Well, it's very much in foreshadowing Taker's role over the next several months.
Oh. Next several days.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay, so King of the Ring, June 24th. Diamond Dallas Page gets his ass kicked for 5 straight minutes by The Undertaker before fleeing through the crowd. This is the first real confrontation of WWF versus WCW, and it does go down in disastrous fashion for WCW.
The thing is, you sit there watching it, and you're waiting for the DDP comeback.
Exactly.
You're waiting for this DDP comeback. You sat there, and there's even a slight tease. I think he gets a low blow in there at one point, and you're thinking, oh, well, this is DDP's time to come back.
Nope.
Oh, wait, no. He's just been cut off with a big boot and he's running through the crowd.
For his life!
Yeah. A low blow ain't going to work. Take it to need some balls first.
And what the hell have I just watched?
Yeah, it was just absolutely awful.
I mean, do we get to talk about King of the Ring now? Because that was basically King of the Ring, wasn't it?
Well, in terms of invasion influence on the show, yeah. that angle, DDP, well, Undertaker, and more, and there's another big thing here, the yep. debut of Booker T at the end of the show, laying out Steve Austin, putting him through yep. a table.
Yeah, there was only two good things on that show. I mean, from King of the Ring. Obviously, one was the Kurt Angle Shane McMahon match, which still I guess had something to do with WCW. And that other moment where Booker T just comes out, and I can remember watching that and just being like hyped for that. I think that was like in contrast to DDP, where like DDP was just getting buried. Like Booker T just comes out and just like takes out Austin and just runs through the crowd. And I was just kind of like, oh, okay, then this is interesting.
But then the interesting thing about all that, despite the siren going off and the WCW running from Booker T, Austin still wins the match.
He does. He
pins Benoit. So
yeah,
what the hell was the point? Yeah. What does it matter? It hasn't cost Austin the title.
Minor inconvenience.
Again, first
that pretty much sums up WCW, doesn't it? In Vince's mind, WCW is a minor inconvenience.
And that's the thing, because these are the first impressions people are getting seeing these WCW guys. And again, it's that thing of immediate impression. The two biggest guys they've got, DDP gets fucking just destroyed, and then Booker T. A lot of good he did.
And then the thing is, the fact they're doing these little run-ins, like you say, with Lance and Hugh previously, kind of makes them look like chicken shits. You know, it's the old, we'll come through the crowd, little snake attack, and run back off. Well, that doesn't seem like a credible threat, does it?
A far cry from the NWO beatdowns of old.
Oh, absolutely.
The Raw after King of the Rings, this is June 25th. Mike Awesome debuts in Madison Square Garden, pinning Rhino backstage to become the illustrious WWF Hardcore Champion. Booker T also attacks Vince McMahon with a scissors kick, and the Raw rating is up a full half point, to a 4.7. So a lot of the lost ground they were starting to make up slowly but surely here by doing these WCW debuts. Okay. The SmackDown after... First of all, actually, before we move on, Mike Awesome, any thoughts on this? Mike Awesome being the guy to come in and win the Hardcore title, any thoughts on this debut or this choice of individual?
They could have done better with him. I think we're all going to have various opinions on how good we think Mike Awesome is. I liked Mike Awesome, and I think like he could have been used quite effectively if he was the bodyguard or the hired goon or whatever, like, the big muscle guy, because they didn't really have like that big muscle guy that could kick. WWF had Big Show and Undertaker and Kane and so on, but WCW didn't really have anyone, and I thought Mike Awesome could at least play that role quite effectively, where he could be the hired hand who can take people out, put people through tables and so on.
But there is a bit of an issue here, and I think it's something that Carl's actually going to touch on, because there's a bit of an illusionary issue.
Yeah, therein lies the problem. You've reeled off a few names there. So the Big Show, you've got the Undertaker, you've got Kane, you've got all these people that physically are just bigger than Mike Awesome. So how do you play off this this big bruising bodyguard in Mike Awesome when you've got X, Y, and Z that are bigger, bad, and nasty? And you've got the issue of coming. I think the Hardcore title thing, I don't want to give it too much credence, because I don't think it deserves it. Frankly, it was a bit of a little nod to the fact that it's a current WCW guy who was an ex-ECW guy, and we know ECW was hardcore wrestling. I think Mike Awesome could have been served probably a bit better throughout the invasion. I think that's fair to say. But I don't think he would have been anything groundbreaking. I certainly don't think he would have been a difference maker. Yeah. He'd already been severely damaged by his WCW run, Fat Chick Thriller.
He recovered from the 70s.
That 70s guy, Mike Awesome. Exactly. He'd been tarnished. So there was only so much you could get out of him.
The worst facials in wrestling.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, he does. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Not for, Mike Awesome never did for me. The spectacles of Tanaka matches, but not for me.
Get me wrong, I didn't think at any point this guy should be alongside Booker T and DDP in terms of the main event, but I think he could have had that good role of being a Paul Heyman in ECW had 9-1. Paul Heyman in ECW had 9-1-1. It was kind of like if Mike Awesome could have been that guy, Shane needs someone's ass to be kicked, and in terms of to answer Carl's question with Undertaker, Kane, Big Show, and I'm talking, obviously there is a size difference. Well, the obvious thing is you just don't have him interact with Undertaker, Kane, and Big Show. You just have him work over the smaller guys.
But then again, that then enforces its own sort of self-imposed ceiling on Awesome's contribution.
Yeah, and that's also a bit of an awkward thing, because you mentioned obviously the 9-1-1 example. The reason why Awesome in ECW and 9-1-1 in ECW was so good is because they were the only big guy in a small man company. In the WWF, he wasn't bigger than Billy Gunn. I mean, in terms of height or physique. So, I mean, honestly, what does that tell you about his ceiling? Is it wasn't even as big as Albert.
Yeah, I guess so. But I'll try and save myself by saying that we still didn't know where the angle was going at the moment. So this still might have been, individually selling an individual company in which he would have been one of the big guys.
that's fair to say.
That's a good point.
That is a very good point. That's a good save. The debuts continue the following SmackDown as Tori Wilson debuts and angle with Vince McMahon. And Sean O'Hare and Chuck Palumbo debut and get beaten to death. The backstage tension was such that the WWF guys continued to beat the hell out of them even after the cameras were turned off in the ring. Palumbo and Sean O'Hare didn't complain, but the entire WCW crew was sent a message. The tensions were becoming very real backstage. There's a lot of from the guys like Undertaker, the APA, and so on.
Well, I mentioned about contracts before and trying to spin it in terms of bringing these new guys in. In much the same respect, when you're looking at TV, you're bringing in these new guys who are taking up TV time from the guys that have worked hard for your company in the first place, and the egos are such of the individuals involved that they just can't see the bigger picture.
First week of July, Linda McMahon in the Fiscal Report says the current plan was to run the first WCW pay-per-view now in October. Things are getting pushed back further and further, if you can notice. It's time for the elephant in the room, the July 2nd Raw. Booker T versus Buff Bagwell in Tacoma, Washington.
You know, to follow with the bad decisions they've made already, which is like, you know, putting Lance Storm first in terms of, you know, firing a first shot, you know, even though I like Lance Storm, you know, and then making DDP the stalker. They then decide that it was a good idea that the best way to showcase WCW is Buff fucking Bagwell.
Bagwell, who somehow got a chance.
Again, well, after shitting in a bucket.
Well, this is the thing. This is the guy that... that walked out on the final Nitro.
Yeah.
A guy that even prior to the last pay-per-view, him and Luger.
With that shocking performance.
The hideous job that they do for Palumbo and O'Hare.
Yeah.
Which is worthy of anything WrestleCrap has ever produced. Buff Bagwell, who gets a reprieve. Gets a reprieve from the Raw audience who, in Liam's words earlier, do him a solid.
Yeah.
Buff Bagwell then proceeds to go and do a solid in the middle of the ring in Tacoma, Washington. The thing is, there are a multitude of people who would have been better served in that position.
Absolutely.
With Booker.
Okay, here's the thing though, not to jump on your point at all, because this is something I want to throw around the table. Mm. Do you think it mattered who it was? Because that crowd, and we'll get to this shortly, but that WWF crowd did not like this at all. And the crowd reaction, they didn't even give that match a chance. And it was bad enough as it was, but they didn't give it a prayer.
I don't think it would have mattered in the grander scheme of things. That you would have probably had a better match if it had been almost anyone other than Buff Bagwell, who hadn't had a good match in forever. but I don't think it would have mattered, because this is a situation where you've thrown these two guys out completely cold. You know, you can say what you want about the run-ins from Booker before and that thing. No one had seen Buff, unless I'm mistaken. So please correct me if I'm wrong. No one had seen Buff on TV, and this wasn't. And it speaks to the sort of the panicky nature of everything. This wasn't advertised ahead of time. This wasn't mentioned on a Raw the previous week, if I'm not mistaken. It wasn't mentioned on a SmackDown in previous weeks.
Not that specifically. They did announce that WCW matches were going to start taking place on WWF TV.
They said they would start taking place, but there was no concrete date ever mentioned. And all that happens is those fans that have turned up in Tacoma to watch a WWF show have been treated to that as their main event.
I think that's definitely a problem. I think, like, first off, you had them in the main event, that's definitely a problem. I think if you had them just a little bit down the show, I think you could have got away with it a little bit more than what they did. In terms of, like, the people who you could have picked, the only thing I can think of to do to showcase what WCW was a little bit, and then if the crowd shits on it too much, it doesn't matter too much, it's not the complete death nail, I probably may have done something like a Billy Kidman versus Sugar Shane Helms. I'd have done a cruiserweight match, which would have had a good action, where at least they would have had a better opportunity than Bagwell to try and get the crowd into the action. And if those two got, like, you know, booed, it wouldn't affect the hierarchy of what they did have in that company, WCW.
But I think the problem you've got there is that in terms of an angle, and in terms of if the idea is still to have WCW as its own entity, which, to Kieran's point about the way that match ends, you can seriously debate whether or not that was still the intention. If you have anyone other than the WCW champion, and if you have them in a position in anything other than the last match on the show, it's going to scream second-rate minor league. And how much is it going to neuter the WWF guys if you've got a WCW match part the way through the second hour, and they just have a nice clean match after the runs they've done. They have a nice clean match. There's a winner, and that's the end of it. The WWF guys are going to look like a bunch of no marks for not getting involved.
That's absolutely a fair point of just saying, like, you know, it's going to, you know, something like that, it would bury, you know, WCW. But saying that, also, it also kind of buried having Austin and Angle come out and beat up the WCW champion anyway.
Yeah, I'm sorry to jump in here, Kieran. I'm actually,
But it's just you know, that's just even worse, isn't it? At least if it was like Kidman or Sugar Shane, again, I like these two guys. I'm afraid to use them as examples. You know, it wouldn't have hurt so much as if they beat down the freaking champion on the show. Surely that's the worst case scenario, if you have Austin and Kurt Angle just beat the champion and throw him out.
I'm not condoning the beat down of Booker T. Buff Bag was a different story. You have to have WWF involvement in some fashion. Even if it's just chasing them out of the ring, you've got to do something. Whether or not that's the right,
it's making it look better and better, aren't we?
Whether or not it's the right thing to do or not, you've boxed yourself. To me, you've boxed yourself into a corner at that point that they have to have some sort of involvement.
I think it was a horrible. Kieran, we'll get to your point now. I think it was a horrible idea to even do this.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing.
Anyway,
it's in a few years. I always, you know, my understanding was it was the precursor to their own show, but. I know, looking at the chronology and the angle afterwards, this is why I'm seriously wondering now, was it just a setup for the on-screen feud rather than actual real intentions? Maybe, maybe not, maybe a bit of both, probably the truth of it. So the original question you asked was if, could it have ever worked? First of all, you need to give the guy some promo time on the show.
Yeah.
If you'd have had Bagwell at the start of the show, though, you could have done work with Bagwell at the start, and again, you need stars. If you'd had Goldberg, yeah, Bagwell do some shitty thing about WWF's going to finally get the buff stuff or what the fuck, and then so he comes out and they'll be shitting all over him, and then Goldberg comes out, they would have lost their mind, and it would have been, they'd gone off the air, it would have been hot as fuck. He's like, Goldberg here to lead WCW, bloody blah, blah, blah. It would have been fantastic. That 2 minutes would have worked fine. But
just on the subject of Buff Bagwell promo time, because we've got to get the story, and there was, do you remember the backstage skit with Bagwell and Shane McMahon where you know, Shane wished him luck and Buff was standing there and said, I don't go on luck, I go on skill. Remember that promo?
Vaguely, yes.
Okay, well, basically, Buff Bagwell's wearing his top hat in that that angle. If you remember the ridiculous Buff Bagwell hat, they told him not to wear the hat right before he went on. So he took it off, he waited till they walked away, and he put it back on. Bradshaw was standing right there, and as soon as the segment was finished and Buff put his hat down, he walked over and put his fist through it. Which is just, again, the tensions are pretty steep here, that people are not liking these WCW guys.
I just want to talk about this. It's, although from a business point of view, and especially with hindsight, you know, we can all say it's short-sighted and you're losing your own, you cut your own wallet by not making opponents for you down the line. But at the same time, when it's pretty obvious by this point that there's not going to be a standalone WCW, or they're struggling to get their own show, and yeah, after coming out of the war, but the roster has just increased probably 25% with no extra TV time. I think you can understand why there's animosity between these guys coming in. From a failed, their ships sunk.
Oh yeah, all these guys like Hardcore Holly, who are surly bastards anyway, they're off the show.
Yeah, you understand? Yeah, and if you know, these guys, we've just saved these guys whose ships sank, and we're going to give them our lifeboats.
And in the case of Buff Bagwell, completely didn't appreciate it. Who's the big story is that, you know, everybody hated Bagwell. He walked into the building, took his shirt off immediately, and just started walking around like a prick, as the story goes. As it was reported on Figure 4 Weekly at the time, Vincent McMahon was irate with how the WCW segment went down on the show. Of all the people who mocked that segment, main event match, no one even came close to matching Vince's unhappiness. Before the show, Jim Ross called all the WCW guys into a meeting, and Vince went off on them, telling them they were lucky to even be with the company and needed to show more respect. Once the meeting adjourned, all the WCW guys went out of their way to act sociable around the WWF guys. Vince was so upset with the whole evening that he refused to even acknowledge any of the WCW guys who were standing near the gorilla position as the show ended backstage.
Very professional.
This is the show, and this match and this main event segment that pretty much kills the idea, as it's reported, of WCW as its own product and as its own show, at least in its current form. And I think the draft idea pretty much dies here as well. And I think this is where they just decide it's going to be an angle from this point forward, nothing more.
Well, to sort of to Kieran's point, you'd have to question how committed they were to a TV show at that point.
I think at worst they were it was a halfway house thing where they were trying to do both, which was doomed to fail in its own right anyway.
Yeah, so. There's no full commitment, and the way that they ended that segment, which we're all in agreement was, you know, it was a terrible end to a terrible segment, but doing it in that manner basically becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy on that, on behalf of the company.
Slicky Tricky Damon, for the moment the invasion died, mentions this match, Booker T versus Buff Bagwell for the WCW title. The angle was hot and then it was dead just like that. The fact they had no knowledge of WCW TV to put a mid-card guy at best as a potential champion was insane. They had DDP and he and Booker had great chemistry. They could have tore the house down and made the invasion start on the right foot. Moving on to the July 4th episode of SmackDown, obviously the one following this, Abysmal Raw, Kidman does in fact beat Hollywood Gregory Helms to win the WCW Cruiserweight title, can't have two Shanes. And then, as soon as the crowd heard WCW for the advertised DDP vs Booker T main event, the crowd got noticeably pissed and 2,000 fans left the building prior to the match even beginning. The audience here was extreme. The WF audience was extremely sour on WCW at this point.
This is everything we've said before, and everything everyone assumed about what you do to a brand to kill it. Talk about self-fulfilling prophecy, but yeah.
They seem to react very, very well to conflict between the two companies. Obviously, we mentioned the O'Hare Palumbo destruction and all the other angles where, you know, things got hot when Booker T was attacking Vince. Those are the angles that seem to work the conflict, but WCW on its own, on the WWF...
Well, it maybe goes back to the tribal thing. People just want to see him exterminate you.
Take that shit back to TBS.
Well, yeah, we'll see you. We'll cheer for you. It's cool if it's part of our show, but we don't want to see your shit.
No, absolutely. And as much as we... and you referenced the beatdown that Palumbo and Hare got earlier, as critical as we can be of that sort of looking back, do you remember what the crowd reaction was to that beatdown? Considering it's a bunch of WWF mid-carders beating down a couple of WCW mid-carders.
Oh, they're going ballistic.
They go absolutely apeshit.
They loved it. They loved the conflict. Speaking of conflict, this is a bit of a weird thing from that episode of SmackDown that a lot of people may have actually forgotten. Outside the building, Diamond Dallas Page, Chris Kanyon, Sean Stasiak, Buff Bagwell, Mike Awesome, Lance Storm and Chavo Guerrero all attack The Undertaker and stomp him down. Shane McMahon races out and tries to break it up, so Page and WCW turns on Shane. Booker T tries to make the save, but the WCW guys beat him up too. So this is really... The train's really fallen off the tracks here with this angle from a creative standpoint. No one barely even remembers this because it ends up... Yeah, exactly.
I absolutely remember. It ended the show.
I don't know that at all.
But it was all part of an elaborate ruse, which I'm sure Liam will now get to.
The next week on Raw, it's an elaborate ruse as they change plans again. Before we get to that, though, after the cameras stopped rolling on SmackDown, those WCW guys hit the ring and just posed. The acolytes and the B-team ran down and pounded on all of them. Buff Bagwell took the stuffed powerbomb twice from the acolytes. As he laid there in the ring selling on his own, they played his music. Bagwell's music. That weekend, Buff Bagwell's mom calls in sick for him so he could have the house shows off from claiming an injury from this attack.
What a pussy.
That's what happens when you wear your hat when you're told not to.
They should have left her up on that pole on that forklift.
The July 9th... So basically, everything's just gone to hell this week. The plans are all... It's clear this is just... The wheels have fallen off this truck and it's just heading off a cliff. Everything's changing. And I remember at the time... Yeah, listen to the air. Because I think the final Observer Radio on Iyada actually took place the day of the next episode of Raw when everything did change. And it was so obvious that they, by this point, it's just seen as a complete and utter disaster. This angle is just... It's getting the last rites at this point. It's only been 3 weeks, you know. The July 9th episode of Raw, Jim Ross meets with and fires Buff Bagwell before the show. But this is, of course, the show with the ECW invasion angle, with... the debut of Rob Van Dam and Tommy Dreamer, the turning of Raven, the Dudleys, Taz, just incredible. And there's one more that's escaped me. Rhino is the sixth guy, along with Storm and Awesome. Heyman gets in the ring and does the great promo about having
off commentary,
rips off the headset, insults the WWF, says the invasion's been taken to the extreme. Everything's good. We mentioned before that all the heat that ECW had, how things really seem to perk up with this. And then WCW and ECW merge. As you alluded to, Carl, in the beginning, they completely ignored the angle on SmackDown, had Shane McMahon and Booker T. It was a plan all along with DDP, to get to The Undertaker the next week on Raw, apparently.
Well, it's all just... You know, they've hit the panic button already, as you've alluded to there.
I think they're smashing it with a hammer at this point.
Well, you know, the panic button's in tiny pieces on the floor. Vince is having a shit fit shouting at anyone in sight. Lance Storm had a funny little story on one of his shoot interviews where he talked about how they did the initial turn, you know, eight or ten of them turn and attack Kane and Jericho, then they all hightail it through the crowd. And he tells a story of they get into the elevator in the arena to sort of, I can't remember if it's to go down a level, go up a level, what it was. But Heyman turns to Storm and says, you know, in about half an hour they're going to fuck this up.
But it's kind of debatable whether, obviously looking at it now when we're going through the timeline, it's kind of obvious that they needed to do something because the angle was dying and they thought ECW was the answer. But when I was when I saw like the highlights of it at the time, I remember obviously liking ECW because I'd started watching it that year, and I was just like excited that ECW was coming back and that Rob Van Dam and even Tommy Dreamer to an extent was in the company. For me, I was quite young at the time, I just thought it would be much better if, I thought it was going to be like a three-way kind of war now. I thought ECW was just going to be there to kind of, you know, shit on both of them basically, like they're just coming in to, you know, screw everyone over. And when they did the whole, they merged with WCW, even though obviously Bischoff wasn't around, it just kind of contradicted everything that ECW was about, at least in its initial stage of Heyman, you know, obviously hating WCW, and now he's getting into bed with the company he hated so much. It just, yeah, it didn't sit well with me when they merged. The alliance, which we should now call them, it just didn't feel well.
This angle for me is like so symptomatic of so many WWE angles in recent times, where we get a seed of imagination that gets tweaked and tickled our fancy just a little bit, what might become, because probably an hour and 50 minutes of that show was exciting stuff. It was, you know, it had what WCW at the start, when they first appeared on TV, didn't have.
A little authenticity.
You had Heyman there as a mouthpiece with the attitude more than anything else. And it was the attitude, you know, wasn't, you could at least suspend your imagination. It wasn't going to get filtered through. There might be some truth in there, which is, inside of wrestling fans, that's what we all, I think, you know, it's what motivates us to watch as much as the on-screen product half the time. But yeah, as soon as it was Stephanie involved and Shane and Stephanie, it was just, it was the 2000 WrestleMania all over again. So.
Well, I think as well, just to compare the two debuts of, like, the Storm debut and the debut of WCW, if you will, to the ECW one. First of all, ECW, as you kind of alluded to, it was popular with WWF fans. Like, I think probably all of us were hoping to see. We wanted to see Van Damme because we wanted to see some of that ECW magic worked into. You know, ECW still had a kind of fond memories, maybe. Well, it hadn't
a lot of goodwill.
It hadn't been sullied, kind of thing. It was, you know, die before, you know, die too early, kind of thing. Rather than WCW, you know, deserved what it got, kind of thing. But as well as that, it was also actually a better angle to introduce
something.
Yeah, rather than this drip feed, because it was near
the WCW there. Drip feed is an interesting point that you kind of touched on earlier.
Also, you got to remember also in terms of like getting that ECW group getting over a lot easier as well, with the exception of Rob Van Dam and Tommy Dreamer. You got to remember that all the other ones had already been in WWF for a while, so you know a lot of the WWF fans were already conditioned to seeing those wrestlers.
I'm not sure it necessarily helps some of those guys.
Okay, conditioned to be in a mid-card role, but at least they were conditioned to kind of like him because they were WWF guys, in contrast to WCW, who they were, you know, made to hate.
I think it's maybe just more natural than that they were the renegade promotion. You know, that was the story that was always told to the fans.
They were cool,
and they were acting like renegades
as well. Also, ECW was an angle, whereas the WCW, as we say, was the intention was not
structured differently.
Yeah, different intention.
They weren't really sure what they were.
Yeah, so you different connotations, different intentions, a different premise to start with, even. Underlying architecture of the idea.
I think this is pretty telling here in terms of the high points. We've got a lot for the ECW. Bad News Gurner from TPWW: when the ECW wrestlers attacked Jericho and Kane on Raw, I was so jacked to see Van Damme and Dreamer, I didn't even put two and two together right away and realise what was going on. Tiger Rick from the UK Fan Forum: high point was definitely the formation of the Alliance, one of those white hot angles. The pop was spine tingling. I assume it means the ECW section.
I can only hope.
Ryan Pelly from Wrestling Forum: I actually loved WCW and ECW aligning. When the ECW side turned literally and face the WWF, I remember thinking, holy shit, this is awesome. That turn around in the ring was pretty great. Also, some of the matches we got were really outstanding. The Van Damme Jeff Hardy series was awesome, we'll get to that. And Peter from Pro Wrestling Only: the high point is also the ECW night. Even in the following days, I was still curious to see how ECW was going to be incorporated and if they were going to hire anybody else from ECW besides Van Damme and Dreamer. It was the follow up that put a damper on things. Speaking of the follow up, we've got a lot of votes here for the night the invasion died for people. TDK from TDK from the UK fan forum. ECW being run by Steph. Ugh. A Splinter Cell Band of Talent would have been better, but Steph walking through that curtain was woeful, and as already mentioned, turned the three big companies fighting into McMahon versus McMahon and narrowed its appeal in my eyes. Bad news, Gertner from TPWW. It died when Steph was revealed to have bought ECW. It turned it into another McMahon angle. Tiger Rick from the UK fan forum. The moment Stephanie walked out as owner of ECW, an hour earlier, I thought they just rescued the whole thing. Then that happened and you knew that everything else would be secondary to the McMahons. And Vic Capri agrees, Stephanie being in charge of ECW. So the dawn and the darkness overshadowing it immediately. Quite interesting to notice, there were absolutely no plans at all after this episode of Raw ended, and the creative team got up early on Tuesday morning to sort through everything and figure out what to do on that night's SmackDown. As a fun little fact here, they did try and talk to Bischoff and Goldberg in the week prior to the ECW invasion to try and bring them in. They were plan A, and the plan for Bischoff was to bring him in only for a short period of time and do a blow-off match with Vince at Invasion, which Bischoff turned down. Goldberg, they couldn't get out of the Time Warner deal, obviously.
Well, clearly there were still bits of that panic button they were trying to find and press, but we've been critical enough of this over the last hour or so. Just imagine what more we would have to say if they'd bought Bischoff in
for three weeks
for a quick throwaway.
Yeah.
Would in typical Vince way, he'd realised what a great performer he was and he'd end up staying around anyway. If he actually got to the situation where he was going to be there for a few weeks, he would have ended up staying there longer.
He may have stayed around longer, but I think he'd have been neutered to such an extent that he would have been worthless in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
But that's not me trying to knock on Bischoff.
No,
don't get me wrong.
You're right, because I think half it as well is, if they had Bischoff from the start, I don't think they would have positioned. I think one of the things about having Shane in there, enabled Vince to be eye to eye with McMahon, so that's not humbling. If he's eye to eye with Bischoff, it's like, well,
the old punching down sort of thing.
Punching down, because Ted Turner's still like, you know, Vince envisioned himself on level with Ted Turner, not on level with Bischoff, who's a step below him, kind of thing. So I think, who knows, how it would have gone. Maybe they'd Kevin Dunn feuding with Bischoff instead. So, who knows?
As a funny note, the WWF was actually illegally using the ECW trademarks at this point. The logo, the music, they didn't own any of it. Exactly. It was still in bankruptcy court. They didn't own any of the ECW stuff at the time.
Which is why they were christened The Alliance.
The Alliance, because they actually couldn't use the ECW initials. An interview with Gregory Helms on WCW.com noted that the WWF was the big time, and he was so happy to be part of the WWF. The same writers were doing the stories on both websites. WWF.com was selling WCW t-shirts. This is the kind of shit that would get you a knuckle sandwich from Bill Watts in 84, but the quality control of just, you know, the credibility of the cable of keeping these things separate is completely out the window at this point.
I think at this point they already realise they've... Well, they haven't killed the golden goose, because there's nothing golden about WCW at that point, but they've killed the goose and they're just trying to milk what's left of the cash cow.
You're a real animal kick tonight, aren't you, Carl?
Well, when you start with Undertaker's wife, it just lends itself.
It does. The July 16th episode of Raw, this week's Raw, was up another 0.3, so the ratings continually grew. We're now back up to a 5.0, so the ratings are looking pretty promising, and this was a great episode of Raw, the return of the old Stone Cold, who comes back and kills everybody to set up, to turn full-fledged babyface and set up Invasion with him as a babyface, ending, in quotes, his disastrous run as a heel.
Yeah.
Or but so late. We thought.
It should be noted here that for the high points, Theo Diaz from TPWW, Freddie Blassie standing up from his wheelchair to cheer on Team WWF, and Austin hitting the ring after beating up everybody backstage. This was Austin's last greatest pop as an active wrestler.
Blassie encouraged Austin to leave the bar, didn't he?
He was watching. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I thought it was a great episode, alright, where they're doing the great speeches backstage, yeah, where Heyman's rallying the troops, and then the Acolytes and Taker do their speech, and then Blassie comes in and gets back the wheelchair. Everybody stands up. Austin's watching from the bar, breaks his pool cue, crowd goes crazy. He's coming back. Yeah. It's coming back, folks.
And he just kicks the shit out of everyone that stands in his way.
Exactly. It was absolutely great.
He pretty much kills the entire Alliance in the space of 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And we've got that wonderful scene with Blassie, as you say. But how does that show end, Liam?
It ends with Steph and Shane saying that, like the WWF, Freddie Blassie will soon be dead.
And we're back to square one.
This leads to Invasion. This is where it all comes down to, at least from this point. This has been a long, long, arduous six-week feud. Yeah. And somehow, despite everything, despite mistake, after clusterfuck, after flim-flammery, it somehow does 775,000 buys on pay-per-view, the biggest buy rate for a non-WrestleMania pay-per-view of all time in the history of the business.
And just to put an asterisk on that, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's 775,000 North American buys.
Yeah,
because we got it for free over here, folks.
We got it for free, and PayPal wasn't as big in other countries yet. Only two things have to be mentioned here. Obviously, the main thing, just stemming from what we were just talking about, the heel turn of Steve Austin.
Yeah.
I think this has to be...
As a great man once said, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me again, well, just can't fool me again. Well, obviously you can, so...
Who said that?
George Bush. Thanks, George. Thanks.
This
a great saying in Tennessee, apparently, according to George. No, Texas, sorry.
Yeah, I'm sure you say it here as well.
This second heel turn in a matter of, what, 4 or 5 months?
Yeah.
This is stage number two on my three stages of hell with this entire angle was the Austin heel turn. Okay, so and as Kieran put it so eloquently, you know, you make the fuck up mistake once of turning Austin heel, which was obviously a bad decision. But then to do the decision again, right? Do the decision again.
To double down on
it. Yeah, double down, right? A few months later, right? After you've turned him babyface and he comes back to a huge reaction, right? Which we got to assume that big reaction on that final war must have contributed at least a little bit to that high buy rate for Invasion. To only fucking turn him heel again, right, at the end of the show, it's just for me, when I was watching it, was fucking mind-blowing. Because watching Invasion, I was enjoying the show right up until that final bit where Austin just turned. And I just after the whole DDP thing as well, and just turned around and said, like, oh, fucking hell, Austin's going to suck the life out of this now. Because this entire angle, this whole alliance angle, is now going to be about Austin. It's like, forget DDP, forget Booker T, forget anyone else that they've got. It's just going to be about Austin and the McMahons now. It's just basically, it's just WWF.
Yeah, for the low points, John Haddock, right around the time of Invasion and afterwards, it just became about the storyline of Austin's heel turn and the identity of the whole thing was gone for me. NWO Black and White from Wrestling Forum, probably when Steve Austin joined the Alliance and basically became the leader. Had Austin been in WCW early in his career? Yes. But he was a WWF guy and I couldn't buy into this.
Yeah.
Not to veer off the beaten track too much, but I would have bet the farm that Jericho was going to turn heel,
yeah,
not
that,
Austin.
That would have been the obvious
they teased
choice.
It for like a month or so, you know, dating back to the King of the Ring, that Jericho was going to turn, and he would have been a much more natural fit because he had room to go up.
Yeah, that's true, but
and he needed to turn heel.
And he did eventually anyway.
Yeah, true, but I think shortly after. Yeah, but can you imagine if they did that? They would have called him a midget and he would have been beaten down time and time again, 2-on-1 handicap matches in his favour. So
it's just tricky. I mean, in terms of, there was so many negatives of that show anyway, that it was just obviously just capped off with the Austin heel turn. I mean, like, obviously talking about like certain WCW guys getting beaten on that show quite decisively in areas, you know, we've already mentioned names like, you know, Lance Storm, Mike Awesome, Palumbo and Hare, they all got beat quite easily. Taz as well, you know, so many names. It was only really when you look at it, the only two people in that alliance that got over in any way, shape or form with the crowd was Billy Kidman and Rob Van Dam.
We'll get to that. Melina MMA from the UK Fan Forum. Personally, I thought the Invasion PV was brilliant from start to finish. Even the bra and panties match was entertaining as far as those type matches go, so this was his personal high points, but a lot of people saw things differently. Jewel Shock from Wrestling Forum. When the Invasion PV ended and no WCW star interfered, I always thought guys like Sting, Nash or Goldberg would interfere in that main event. That was the moment I realised this angle would not have any of the WCW greats. Promoter 2003 from Wrestling Forum. I think the Invasion pay-per-view was the low point, even though I knew it was highly unlikely guys like Sting or Goldberg were ever going to appear. The thing is, the way the Monday Night War happened, fans were trained to believe that something epic like that would happen at the big event, and when it didn't, and the surprise was Stone Cold, I guess that jaded him. Mm. The other thing that we got to mention, that we mentioned there were two noticeable points. Obviously, one was the awful decision to turn Steve Austin heel again. The other was the birth of Rob Van Dam as a mainstream player, because there was a hell of a lot of excitement going in and even more coming out. So I don't know who wants to hit this point first, but RVD.
Yeah, RVD. As I stated earlier, on the lead up to Invasion, I was doing my heavy research on ECW. 2001 when I started watching it, ironically, after it closed. And the main guy who obviously I was watching it for was Rob Van Dam, because I heard a lot about him being great, and I was just like, I want to see what this guy's made of. And obviously just loving his ECW work. When it came to like Invasion, I don't know about like you guys, but I was feeling nervous.
Yes.
Before that show.
I was so nervous, right?
And I'm really kind of intimidated, like, what are they going to do? Are they going to let him do what he's capable of? I'm sure they'll let him do his frog splash and his Rolling Thunder, but are they going to let him do, you know, his corkscrew leg drop and his Van Damme and 18, you know, like all these kind of like real hardcore moves that he is prone to hurting people with.
And did.
You know, are they going to let him wrestle his style?
The second match, the ladder match.
Second was the ladder match.
At SummerSlam, yeah.
What the fuck was he trying
that
to do?
Spinning.
What the? He missed by 12 feet anyway.
I have no idea how they could have possibly thought they were going to pull that off.
Yeah. That match was absolutely fantastic. Loved every moment for it. Marked out like, you know, a 17-year-old would when he did hit the Van Daminator on Jeff Hardy and then won the hardcore title, which was the only title on the line that night.
A lot of the thing, because obviously there's always that great thing as a wrestling fan. It's kind of a bit of a hipster thing, that whole, there's a guy I know that the world hasn't seen, and goddamn if he ever gets the chance, he could set the world on fire. But just to go with what you said with the nervous thing, I was so convinced that Van Damme was just going to fuck up so many times on the big stage. I just thought this could be a complete clusterfuck with him and Jeff Hardy.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be Bagel Mark too. He's like, oh, he's going to fuck something up. I'm not going to see him again, so let's enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah, but that's the thing. As that match went long, you just got to see more and more of the Van Damme we knew and loved, you know, topped off by that fantastic Van Damme-inator on the stage. It was that coming of age, and I remember the next day I was hanging around a lot of wrestling fans the next day, and everybody was talking about Van Damme. That was the big issue. Moving along from Invasion, the following night's Raw, Lance Storm gets a breadcrumb and wins the Intercontinental title off Albert, and The Rock was reinstated in an announcement by Vince McMahon. So Rock's coming back. July 26th episode of SmackDown, Booker T hands over the US title to Chris Kanyon and then loses the WCW title to Kurt Angle in the main event. This is in Pittsburgh, but again, a bit of a questionable decision here for Booker T to lose the WCW title.
Doesn't he get it back?
He gets it back the following episode of Raw. But again, what's the point? I mean, quick hometown pop for Angle, great, but
yeah, I don't give a shit about that.
Craig Atkinson, by the way, from you mentioned here that his low point was Booker T losing the title.
Yeah. Well, it just goes back to that sort of panicky nature of everything. It's the one constant throughout the whole process. I can picture Vince probably thinking in sort of a very narrow mindset. Austin's turned on Angle. Angle's the guy who's taken the fall. We need to do something for Angle. Mm. Putting the belt on him and beating Booker T is entirely the wrong thing to do, but I can just picture what Vince's thought process probably was at the time.
The July 30th episode of Raw, The Rock returns and Raw does a 5.7 rating. This is the peak of the ratings during this entire period. Ratings are up a full point in the last 3 weeks alone. Booker T also gets the belt back from Kurt Angle and the first title versus title match as X-Pac beats Billy Kidman. Yeah, Mike Awesome loses to Bob Ollie on Heat and Billy Gunn on Jacked. He's in the doghouse as because The Undertaker got word out that he can't work WWF style.
There's a pattern here, folks.
There is a pattern. The August 2nd SmackDown, Steve Austin accepts Kurt Angle's challenge for SummerSlam after being hit with a cookie tray by Deborah. The state of this angle now.
Where's the Price is Right tuba when you need it?
August 6th Raw, Edge versus Lance Storm at SummerSlam is set up when Edge and Christian pull down Storm's tights, revealing Power Ranger underwear.
Good reason for a feud.
The heat ranges on in this feud. August 9th SmackDown, Test joins the Alliance. The ranks are just
further dilution.
Helping DDP and Kanyon win the WWF tag team titles. Kane and Undertaker beat Palumbo and Sean O'Hare to win the WCW tag titles.
Of course.
Everyone keeping track so far?
Yeah.
The following week on Raw, Taker and Kane bury Sean O'Hare and Chuck Palumbo in a cage match, and that's the last we see of Sean O'Hare and Chuck Palumbo because they can't work WWF style.
You just go through all these kind of different title changes, starting with that historic X-Pac Billy Kidman change, which obviously was a change in the wrong direction if you're obviously going to unify the titles prematurely.
This all leads to SummerSlam on August the 19th, and Carl, this is something that I know that you want to get into because this is a bit of a hot button issue, this pay-per-view.
Well, I've been keeping my powder dry for this one. This is the show that I've affectionately dubbed The Empire Strikes Back. Because for anyone out there who still believed there was some semblance of a genuine feud here, this is the show that completely puts the kibosh on it. Yep. You have a WWF crew that absolutely steamrolls the Alliance. Edge gets the Intercontinental title from Lance Storm. As we've already alluded to,
yeah.
Rock beats Booker T. Angle beats Austin, but that's a bit of a misnomer to me, because that was a continuation of the feud, in truth.
Edge beats Storm as well.
But you have the real crux of it.
Andy Howitt, for his low point, mentions this, Carl, so if you want to get into this point now.
This just, if you thought DDP had been treated badly before, this just absolutely sums it up to a T. A cage match which is an absolute burial. You know, guys who can't work WWF style, and DDP had been lumped into that category, Undertaker absolutely annihilates him, to the point where they even let his tag team partner climb out of the cage and escape to continue the beatdowns even more. By the end of this, there is no hope, folks. any slight excitement that had been brought back by the increased point in the rating for the Rock return is completely wasted. Such is the lack of focus and lack of emphasis on the Alliance WWF feud that they actually have WWF versus WWF matches.
Yeah.
4 weeks after the invasion angle, which is supposed to be the big kickoff, we've got Tajiri against X-Pac for the Cruiserweight Light Heavyweight title.
Yeah. Everything you're saying, Carl, I absolutely 100%. Oh,
and sorry, if I can just jump in just quickly, the final score in terms of Alliance and WWF was 6-2. Folks at home keeping score, it was 6-2.
Yeah, absolutely agree 100% with everything you say. And I'd say, however much hatred you have for this show is just equaled by me. As I said, this was the final straw for me. Like, it'd been bad enough with DDP and with Austin turning heel, but this, as you stated, with almost close to a complete whitewash of WCW, and
DDP gets squashed.
Yeah, DDP gets squashed. I mean, I guess Kenny got away, almost scot free from that. Almost.
I don't know about that.
Almost.
There is a big story. I'm not to jump here too much, but there was a big story the next night where the talk of the locker room was how that match went so much differently than they were told to do it. Obviously, DDP and Kenny were supposed to get a lot more offense than they did.
Yeah, I believe that firmly. The thing that just kind of got me was obviously WCW losing a lot of their matches, but also, like, how many WCW guys were actually on the show, right? And then you got the two main titles, the world title and the WWF title, and of the four guys competing for those two titles, three of them are WWF guys.
And the other one does the job.
And the WCW guy does the job, exactly. And so I was just like watching this.
The only guy they didn't protect.
Yeah, and it was just like, and he'd already lost the fucking title earlier to Angle anyway. And it was just like, just remember watching this show just going like, now it's gone. Like, now I can't even savour anything from this apart from Rob Van Dam. It was just like, this whole Alliance angle is fucking dead. They have no intentions to put anyone over, especially like Booker T. And it is such a shame, because like, Booker T is good, man. Like, he was good, you know. And like, him and Rock, actually, from like from a match perspective, wasn't actually too bad. You know, they had actually had like a decent bit of chemistry between each other, and I'm sure it wasn't Rock's intention to bury Booker T.
I'm amazed you're able to keep with it up to that point, because I'd given up before the show.
I had a lot of willpower.
I gave up before the show, but the show just reinforced that I was along the right lines, because I don't think that I'm doing the cage match justice. DDP is made to look so pathetic.
First of all, they fuck up his entrance.
They fuck up his and Kenya's entrance. DDP is made to look so pathetic by the end of it, that he is given the chance to escape by the Undertaker, so long as he promises not to stalk his wife anymore. Taker, of course, changes his mind and buries him anyway. But, you know.
And then, Carl. And then. But wait.
But wait. There's more.
The next night.
We get to Monday Night Raw.
And I'll let you go.
Monday Night Raw. As if DDP hasn't been treated badly enough, he hasn't been shat on enough from such a great height, pom pilot or no pom pilot, tripping up, no tripping up. This is a man who lost close to $500,000 because he wanted to be part of the big show. And what's his eventual reward? What's his send-off whilst he goes to get an injury taken care of? He gets to job to the Undertaker's wife.
Sarah Undertaker pins him on Raw. In the Undertaker spinning pose, Carl is hanging his head. I think I see a tear gently rolling down his cheek.
You thought the last time Secretariat got a race win was 1977? You're wrong, folks. Secretariat gets the W in 2001.
After the burial of Diamond Dallas Page, the August 30th episode of SmackDown, The Undertaker refuses to do the pinfall job in his handicap match against X-Pac and Albert, and has a DQ finish and leaves them laying instead. This rampage continues to the September 4th SmackDown, where his good friend's Chronic debut. Chronic, thoughts on Chronic around the table? It's a last-ditch effort. Was this, did this turn the corner for you, Carl, or Kira, in terms of WCW authenticity?
It did not, but it was kind of suitable comeuppance for Undertaker lobbying him to getting them in and having a fucking god-awful match. Debut up there was Scott Steiner versus Triple H, I'd say. So, yeah.
On that same episode, actually, Rob Van Dam noticeably pinned Steve Austin. This is where they do the angle where Austin's pissed, and the next guy to walk through the door is the guy that he's going to wrestle. It ends up being Van Dam, who they're chanting for all night in the building. And, you know, very surprising finish. Van Dam pinned Steve Austin. It's been very obvious here that Rob Van Dam is one of the few highlights of the Invasion at this point, and this is a popular opinion because of all the things that happened during the Invasion, the one thing that got the most votes for the high point, appropriately enough, is Rob Van Dam. Michael Mush from the UK fan forum: the personal high spot for me was how over Rob Van Dam became. I loved RVD in ECW and didn't really think he would become so popular so quickly in the WWF. John Haddock says that RVD getting exposed to a worldwide audience and being the most over person during that time, he was white hot and so different from anyone else on the roster, the crowd loved him. Smelly Meatball from TPWW forums: RVD being mega over with the crowd even though he was part of the enemy side. And Shane O'Mac version 2 from the UK fan forum: I had no idea who any of the Alliance guys were really, but I remember thinking that RVD was the coolest wrestler ever. I wish he got the feud with The Rock instead of Jericho at the time. The match with Jeff Hardy at Invasion was unlike anything I had ever seen. RVD was obviously the one of the shining beacons here, and obviously got a hell of a push, you know, beating The Rock on TV, beating Austin on TV, ended up with the three-way match at No Mercy, where it's Austin, Angle, and Van Damme.
Yeah, just ask a question to everyone here. Personally, I think he should have won the title in that triple threat at No Mercy. What do you guys think? Would you have put the title on Rob Van Dam at that time?
I was a big, me and Kieran were on the bandwagon pretty hard with Van Dam at the time, but Carl, I'm sensing from you there's a little bit of a contrarian opinion here.
I'd not because I'm anti-RVD or anything like that, but I'd be hesitant to have put the belt on him there. The way everything was so sort of chaotic at the time, my concern of him winning the belt in a triple threat match, I could just see him losing it in 3 weeks, or losing on a Raw or SmackDown, not necessarily even getting to a pay-per-view.
Yeah,
with the
as happened with Kurt Angle after the Unforgiven win.
As happened with Kurt, as we saw, you know, the hot shot under the WCW title with Booker. So I'd be worried for him from that perspective. I think there is an argument to be made that you can still pull the trigger on Van Damme without putting the belt on him there. You can have Austin beat Angle to sort of, you know, to take Angle out of the mix, and then you can go full board with a singles feud with Van Damme and Austin, which is the way it needed to go, really.
Yeah.
And if you're going to do that, you've got to have Van Damme as the babyface chasing the title for me.
Kieran, what are your thoughts on the upside of Van Damme during this period of time? Do you think he could have been... Because, I mean, again, he was the one cool thing, and he was over huge for a period of time.
Yeah, in a period which, even though it's such a state of flux, it was ended up being... thing very samey because of obviously we mentioned the overarching McMahons, and it was, you know, WWF guys representing the Alliance, things like that. Van Damme was a breath of fresh air, and really I think he kind of epitomised what we all hoped we'd get out of an Invasion kind of thing, you know, stars that we see in other companies coming and showing their in all their glory on what we perceive as the big stage, as the end stage.
That's a great point, actually.
However, I would say he beat Rock, beat Austin, but did he get any clean wins?
He got clean wins over guys under that level. Yeah. So, the Jerichos of the world.
Well, I think, and that's my point. I think it kind of, although as fresh and as fun as it would have been, I think history kind of tells us how it would have gone, as Carl rightfully said. And I think, given the fact that if they had any faith, he would have got probably more than he did, and just I think just that lack of faith, mate. Lack of, who knows? Maybe if they'd gone with it with a short term view and it had clicked, and there was nothing else, they would have gone with it and gone full ball. My gut tells me, in the grand scheme of things, it would have ended up like Carl says, like so many others, if they'd gone too much too early.
There probably would have been an opportunity. We're all considering that there was two world titles in that situation, and I mean, maybe he was in the wrong title contention. Maybe if they wanted to keep, you know, you know, the top guys battling for the WWF title. Maybe the WCW title might have been a better route for Rob Van Dam. Maybe if he, not saying like he beats Rock or anything, like, you know, they could have took the title off Rock for someone else to lose to RVD, I guess. But
if,
like,
if you're going to be serious about Van Dam, I don't see the harm in putting him in there with a Rock. I mean,
no, I guess, yeah, I'm sure probably Rock would have been gracious enough to do a job.
The September 10th Raw, the Undertaker's streak continues. Booker T beats him with the axe kick, gets the pin in the middle of the ring, but Taker gets his shoulder up at 2.5, which is a source of consternation amongst the wrestlers at the time that he would do that. And then this leads, of course, to Unforgiven, Chronic's famously shitty match, Adams and Clark.
It was a pair of talentless fucks in there with another talentless fuck in Kane and an egotistical fuck in The Undertaker. So as a result, I didn't give a fuck.
Carl's out of beer.
There were very few opportunities during this time where they actually had chance to get people over. I mean, we just talked about Rob Van Dam. I also, during this time period, want to mention Taz. Okay, because during this time period, yeah, there's this whole angle where, you know, Austin was, you know, leading by example, and he was just having a go at anybody in the Alliance who would lose a match, right? And he would do this whole, like, public assembly in the ring where he would just, like, just absolutely destroy them verbally and then do something insulting, like, you know, like hit him with a belt or whatever and so on. And this happened with everybody. And I think it was, like, Tommy Dreamer, Hugh Morris, I think they all
is
took it.
Is that humorous?
Yeah, is that humorous? What?
Funny, you know, team.
Yeah, this is the beginning of the whole what thing that he was doing. And yeah, it just kept going, and everyone just took it. And then he did it to Taz, and I don't know what it was. I don't know whether it's like the way Taz sold it, where like something in the look in his eyes or in his face, where he was just saying like, "I don't like this."
All the love had gone from them.
Yeah, it was just like, "I don't like this," and the crowd picked up on it. And I don't know how long they ran this brief, very brief angle for. Like, I think it was only for like a couple of weeks at best. But as this angle was developing, where like he keeps trying to humiliate Taz, and Taz isn't biting. He's just standing his ground, and he's not going to like fall away like Dream or Hugh Morris and so on, those lot. And the crowd are getting more and more into it. And they're starting to like, and you're starting to think, like, I'm watching it going like, as a huge Taz mark anyway, I'm thinking, Jesus, are they actually going to do something with Taz here? Is he actually going to break away from the pack and turn babyface on Austin? Is he going to choke him out? I was just waiting for it, and I thought for a very brief time, I thought they might actually do it. I thought like, whether it was, you know, natural, whether it's like something they planned or whether it's just something that was organically happening in front of them, I just thought that was definitely at least a chance of someone else other than Rob Van Dam getting over in the Alliance.
And nothing happened.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah, look what happens. You know, nothing happens. It just falls away after like a couple of times they did it, and everyone just forgets about it. But I fucking didn't.
Hey, at least we got what out of it.
We did get one
out.
Yeah,
that fantastic fucking thing.
Hey, that was funny for like a month.
At this point, the invasion is just a complete disaster. The Raw ratings dropped to the low fours by September from the peak of July 30th at 5.7. They're already down to the low fours by September. So we're going to breeze through the real Cliff Notes version here of what happened at the end of Invasion, because none of this is worth talking about. Van Damme is over huge, but loses at No Mercy. Rock begins his feud with Chris Jericho, which is actually a very entertaining feud, but really doesn't have any bearing ultimately on the Alliance Invasion situation.
And again, it's two WWF guys facing over
for the WCW title. Booker T loses to Taker at No Mercy, so, you know, good things are happening there. Christian joins the Alliance, just to further nullify the authenticity. DDP debuts his new gimmick, and that's not a bad thing, that's a good thing. The Paul Heyman promo on the final episode of SmackDown is something that we should probably mention here, because the promo that probably should have been done way earlier in the feud of Paul Heyman's underlying hatred. This is the one where he name drops Bruno and Bret and Hogan. It's the taboo promo on SmackDown. You're not supposed to say.
Was it Hogan's blood and
Shawn Michaels' smile and Bret's dream?
Bret's dreams, yeah. And you bought a private jet, and you built Titan Towers with it, and it was just like,
you did it off my ideas, which is.
That was a great promo, that really was.
Yeah, it's one of those great Heyman promos that really stood the test of time.
Too little, too late.
Yeah, absolutely too little, too late.
Yeah. Bless Heyman for trying, though. Okay, you know, he did try.
He's just really good.
Yeah, he's really good, but he was trying. He was the only one at that point still trying.
Guys are flip-flopping. Angle joins the Alliance.
Angle plays Austin for a while. Austin's playing as Angle, and then I think it all culminates eventually with... and was Vince, I guess he was a face, but still a heel. No, he was a face, definitely a face. And eventually, he goes full circle. WF wins. Austin's still a heel. Next night on Raw, Flair turns up. Vince turns back to Vince. Austin turns back to Austin.
The angle hero becomes a heel.
And yeah. We can all pretend that he never turned at WrestleMania X7. None of this actually ever happened.
Survivor Series is, of course, winner takes all, the final 10-man tag to decide, you know, who really is the true supreme company after all this, I suppose. Survivor Series only does 450,000 buys and does over 10,000 fans at the Greensboro Coliseum, which seats 23,000, so it cannot be deemed a success. But for the pivotal final blow-off of the end of WCW and ECW versus the WWF, disappointing at
best. I'm really surprised, actually. If they had further next night, they didn't debut him on that show. It was like,
in Greensboro!
Yeah, but then obviously what you'd do, you'd obviously turn on WCW, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
just to really fuck everyone. Just when you think, if anyone is stupid enough to think that now Flair's turned up, we're maybe actually going to restart the whole thing all over again, it right this time. Nah,
done.
He hates WCW.
last two guys who it went down to in the end were Austin and Rock, the two WWF guys.
And the decider was Kurt Angle.
Yeah, three WWF guys deciding over WCW and ECW.
Angle was the Angle Austin were the last two on, and this obviously the same week as Austin, so at Angle had actually turned heel.
Yeah.
Obviously that was a swerve, I guess.
That was
swerve. Although the next night,
because Angle's a heel, but Austin's a heel too, but he becomes a babyface.
When Austin was a babyface, what does that make Angle?
Yeah, but Vince was a babyface, but he was actually a heel.
If we're making this sound confusing, fans, we're just reciting events. We apologise.
At the end of the day, folks, we've got a situation where the parent company, if you like, in the WWF, had an idea when they purchased WCW. That idea quickly fell by the wayside, and they'd boxed themselves into such a corner from the way they'd gone forward with the purchase that they had to do something with it. The way it transpired, they took wrong turn after wrong turn after wrong turn. Every mistake that they could have made, they made. To the point where, even despite all their issues and an initial interest, as evidenced by the Invasion pay-per-view, which is a traditionally B show for the company, did 775,000 buys. By November of that year, they've lost close to half that interest. And the feud ends with the same two guys that were wrestling in the main event at WrestleMania 17 in April. So you've basically got a situation where, through all the contrived twists and turns, it all may as well have never happened.
And on that note, to bring it back to the original point, just to summarise around the table, was this whole thing always doomed to fail, in your opinion?
I think what Carl said just then about box themselves into a corner, I completely 100% agree with, and I think you probably take it back to the simulcast, just the way they laid the table out there. I think the way they laid the table out from that point, box themselves into a corner. Obviously the initial idea was never going to work, but because it was there, they ran with it. Just another angle, let's fill some time till Rock returns, maybe, who knows. Austin's not working, Triple H is injured, we need an angle, we need a storyline, let's do this. And that's where it basically degenerated to pretty quickly. But again, as I say, I think the fact that they forced themselves into doing it in such a quick turnaround, I think that's probably the biggest death knell to them, was the panic they gave themselves.
If Vince could do it again, do you think he would change anything?
In hindsight, he'd know. If he goes with the approach that he wouldn't, a separate brand, a separate company isn't going to the way it's going to go, because they know that's going to be a failure. So you're looking at it straight away, you're approaching it as an angle from the beginning. So that's a massive positive for it, in my opinion. But the biggest thing would have been, I think, to slow it down and take the time and get the guys in that are actually going to make a difference and do a proper angle, rather than a half-assed botched job of a bunch of mid-carders on the whole.
So have it go away completely on the final night and come back later on?
The fact that it still did 775 after 6 months or whatever, it wasn't that long, was it? A few months of dross with a second-rate crew, half WWF guys as it was anyway. I think if you'd have taken it away, don't have it on WWF TV at all. What's all that did was alienate WCW fans. Don't have
WWF fans too.
Don't advertise it on their TV at all, and then bring it back fresh. It's completely separate. Don't cross. It's completely counterintuitive, but Yeah, I think cross pollination probably hurt it more than anything else. But if you take take the time and get a couple of guys, Bischoff, a Flair, and a Goldberg, as a starting point to build something around and actually give people a reason to care about it. I think that's the main thing. It was rushed and completely unprepared, which is why we saw it change in dynamic from start and through its life cycle, really.
Chase, doing from the start.
I agree with a lot of what Kieran just said, actually. I think timing was definitely an issue on this one. I think at the very least they could have postponed it by about like 6 months at the least, and maybe started the initial attack, the first shot fired. They could have started that around SummerSlam time. The five names I would put in there, sixth one would be Bischoff, because he's Bischoff, for Christ's sake. The five names, they already had two of them. They already had DDP and Booker T that you could do something with. And the other three names, which you'd have to spend money on, would have been, for me, Scott Steiner, Sting, and Goldberg. So I certainly think if they just waited a little while longer, probably secured those five names, in which three of them they would have to have secured extra, and Bischoff, I keep forgetting him. I think if they just waited and just got those six guys, that would have made a lot of difference. I'm not saying this angle would have instantly been a success, but it certainly would have been a lot better than what they did.
There are two plausible scenarios to me. If Vince could jump in the DeLorean and go back in time. The first, as you've mentioned, is to hold off. To hold off to get some of those big names. Now, to me, the way their deals are structured and the fact that in terms of their expiry dates, to me, you'd have to wait too long, because you've got to wait till November to get Flair. You've got to wait till February to get in the NWO guys, if that's where you want to go. You've got to wait another year on top of that to get Goldberg.
Yeah.
And those guys aren't opting out of their deals, folks. It's not happening. So I think too much time's elapsed by that point for me personally. It's too far out of the stream of consciousness to bring it back and for it to be anything more than a slight buzz for a few months, which is in the end is what it ended up being anyway.
Yeah.
The other scenario to me, with Vince being Vince, is that he just wouldn't do it at all. I think he'd maybe buy the trademarks, buy the tape library, bring the other guys in at a later date, but he wouldn't do an invasion angle.
I gotta think that's almost like a damned if you do, damned if you don't, because whilst he did do it and kind of failed at it and we're sitting here today complaining about it, I think if he didn't do it at all and just didn't know, after buying WCW, buying the name and buying some of the people involved, and he didn't do anything involving WCW, we'll be sat around here today turning around going, well, why the fuck didn't he do an invasion angle? We'd be complaining, a different complaint, but we'd still be complaining that he didn't do the angle. So it's a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah, but we're working from the notion that Vince knows all this before he goes back in time.
No, I just agree with you there. What you said, Cole, about would even do it. I absolutely don't think he would in its current guise anyway. That's why I say you'd have to change it and be patient with it, because no way, if you say, okay, you've got these guys, these 24 guys and DDP coming in, do you want to launch? Do you want to do an invasion angle with these guys? They say fuck no, we're not going to do that. They wouldn't even start the angle. But because the way they went into it, hoping to start a separate brand at the start, that's when they were kind of freewheeled into it, and so they ended up doing it. But I don't think no way would he have tried to do the invasion angle knowingly with that crew at the start. No way.
Yeah, I think for my own opinion here, I think the more I think about it, the more that we talk about it today, we break down that the change in events. I think that with the attitude at the time, couldn't have made it its own brand, because the television environment didn't want it without the big stars, and the angle itself had a ceiling on it without the same stars. And if they weren't willing to make that commitment, and we can talk about all the names we want, Goldberg was the one that mattered in terms of the big money, the real big money. Goldberg meant so much more than everybody
and
else.
And he ain't coming.
And he ain't coming. There's no way to get him. So I think, I hate to put it in this simplistic terms, Flair would have been a lovely addition for the identity. Bischoff would have been great for the money promos. Sting and Steiner, lovely bonuses for sure to help the angle if you're going to do it that way. But the one that mattered for the money was Goldberg. And if they weren't going to get him, I think it was doomed to fail, because you can't deliver. Hey, when they first did the angle, they weren't chatting anything else. That was all people wanted, was that idea of the dream matches. And if they can't do the dream matches, what can they give you?
Yeah, and in the long run, with all those kind of names you mentioned, with the exception of Sting, they eventually kind of got like a good deal out of it anyway, because they got, instead of just having them all in one go, they kind of like drip feeded them through the next several years, where just like, okay,
years, you know, dross, you, though. There's no,
it didn't really no work though, that's the thing.
So you can bring them in, so yeah, so the only way to get value is I get the point of, does WCW in general lose steam, but what steam did it have when they started anyway? They say straight away the old crew stopped watching, so
the old crew stopped watching, yeah. It's a dead brand to the fans who are still there.
So for me, it's, there is no downside to delaying. Star power still can be star power, yes, about being out of the limelight, but WCW was such a fucking clusterfuck at the end anyway. What was a year away from TV for me?
It would have helped to rehab the memories of wrestling fans at the very least.
Get a little bit nostalgic for the days of WCW without that company there for a year.
Well, yeah, you never know what condition WWE would have gone into if they didn't do that invasion angle. You don't know where WWE would have gone in the next couple of years. Maybe in 2 years' time, the crowd might have been begging for a WCW invasion angle.
Well, exactly. It's I firmly believe that the time wouldn't have hurt it, but hey-ho.
Yeah. I want to thank everybody for the amount of feedback. Thank you for joining us on this absolute odyssey of a podcast. If we didn't get to your feedback this time, I apologise, but there was so much to discuss. For Kevin O'Rourke.
Au revoir, mes amis.
For Carl Jones.
Arrivederci.
For G. John Chase.
I'm going to start a petition, folks. Yeah, I want to change Monday Night Raw to Late Night Appetite. We can do this, folks. There'll be information on the next podcast.
This music that we're hearing now seems apropos. Thank you very much. I am Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here.